Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Twanda Black, your host. And breast cancer remains the second most common cancer among women in the U.S. It's estimated that 175,000 American women are living with metastatic breast cancer. And nurse Heather Sulzbach joins us. She is an advanced oncology nurse practitioner at NYU Langone Arena Oncology, and she's provided outpatient care for those living with cancer for more than a decade. And good morning, Heather.
Good morning.
You know, we hear a lot about women with metastatic breast cancer, and we also, there is also a fear because it's so tremendous and so all-encompassing. So tell us about metastatic breast cancer.
So breast cancer, metastatic breast cancer is cancer that has moved beyond the breast and the breast tissue and lymph nodes to other parts of the body.
Mm-hmm.
So it is an advanced stage. It is otherwise known as stage four.
Mm.
But it is treatable. It is controllable.
Well, and a lot of people don't think so. Once, you know, you get that diagnosis of stage four, usually you're making plans, you know, to leave. And that's been our experience with people that I've known personally that've had metastatic. And once they find out the diagnosis, it's not long before they're gone.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, we are making amazing strides with treatments. And one of them is, hormonal therapy, because there are different types of metastatic breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's based on, you know, the different characteristics that would be hormone receptor statuses.
So what does that mean?
Yeah, so an estrogen or progesterone, which are hormones that actually would be fueling the cancer.
Mm.
So to treat someone that has estrogen-positive breast cancer, we would use an anti-estrogen. We would use oral therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So 75 to 80% of these breast cancers have estrogen and progesterone receptors, and then 50% of them, with hormone receptor positivity, will respond to hormone therapy. So it's not what it used to, where it's one size fits all. Let's give everybody the intravenous chemo, and
right,
we're doing better with prolonging life and, more importantly, quality of life.
Mm-hmm. So, and I know this might be a crazy question to ask, but so women who have had hysterectomies, all of that, you know, are they still dealing with that kind of breast cancer that's a hormone receptor?
That is such a really great question. So I'm going to take you back to someone who meaning before, you
mm-hmm.
know, menopause. Those women have estrogen, you know, mainly from their ovaries.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the, we would still treat them with estrogen downgraders and anti-estrogen therapies, and sometimes even, you know, in a different genetic setting, maybe have removal of the, you know, ovaries. Women that are postmenopausal, though, that are not making it from the ovaries, they still produce smaller amounts of estrogen, and because basically the adrenals still, you know, were circulating. It's a hormone called androgen.
Mm-hmm.
Androgen actually converts to estrogen through a step series. So we would use a different set of, you know, hormone blockers, hormone therapy, essentially, with those women.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that actually is a great question. There's still, even though there's no ovaries or anything, there is still circulating estrogen. So that's why a huge goal is to, you know, maximize hormone therapy
mm-hmm.
if the woman has ER positivity,
mm-hmm.
which is estrogen.
Okay, that's really interesting. And like, I've heard about the hormone receptor, but not, you know, I'm glad you're going into detail about it. You're talking about a campaign and educating us in this campaign about Beyond Pink. So what is this campaign about?
The website is called lifebeyondpink.com.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a remarkable website, you know, guidebook essentially for patients and families, and it really helps to it teaches women how to actively manage this journey.
Mm-hmm.
So it has, discusses the basics to treatment options, to side effects management, and different questions to ask. And one of my favorites is the Mythbusters, because there's just so many myths.
Right.
And there's women writing, living, saying, I have metastatic breast cancer for 8 years, and this is what. And I, you know, you do see that clinically. We're seeing, you know, one of the myths is that there's a very, you know, low survival rate with these great treatments and hormone therapies and the different treatment modalities, targeted therapies, it's patients are able to live full, productive lives.
That's really good to know. That is really awesome to know. Anything a newly diagnosed patient should know about metastatic breast cancer?
Have support. You're not alone. Mm-hmm. Find an oncologist that you, have faith in, even if it takes one or two opinions, someone that you're comfortable with, someone that's going to be, this is going to be, the quarterback,
mm-hmm.
and someone with a staff that you're comfortable, because the support, she must be multidisciplinary, the social worker, the nurse practitioner, physician assistant, and just educating, making sure have copies of everything, have like a binder, and write down questions so they don't forget, and really have hope. The initial part is the hardest, but to know that there's so many different treatment plans,
that is really good to know.
May make her feel a little more positive.
Yes, because I'm sure that when you hear that diagnosis and somebody says stage 4, that's kind of a moment to go a little haywire in your mind, but stay positive, because there are treatments for it. There is survival rates in there, right?
Absolutely. And there's also, I'm watching this being turned into a chronic disease, where patients are living and living and living, where it has gotten better than, it has been.
That's really great to know. Heather, tell people where they can go to get more information.
LifeBeyondPink.com.
Okay. And this is Heather Sulzbach. She is a nurse practitioner, an advanced oncology nurse practitioner, and an expert, an educational expert in metastatic breast cancer. Thank you so much for joining us, Heather.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Twanda Black, your host. And a lot of us know someone who is living with autism. I know we have some folks in our family. And this is such an interesting topic. We never think about, it takes so much for granted. We never think about autism and love and autism in love. Matt Fuller joins us. He's director of Autism in Love. It's an independent lens film on PBS. And can't wait to see it, Matt. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great, Twanda. Thanks so much for having me this morning.
You're welcome. Why the interest in autism?
Well, it's interesting. I prior to making this film, I really had very little knowledge or understanding of autism. My life had not been affected by it yet. My producing partners, Dr. Ira Heilville and Carolina Gropa, had started doing some research for what they thought was going to be a book about adults with autism and romance,
mm-hmm.
Which they knew was an underserved conversation, but didn't realize how vacant that conversation was.
Mm.
So they started digging into it and didn't find much, and thought, well, maybe this is a project that we could turn into a documentary. And that's where I came into the fold. Knowing very little about autism, what I did know was that it seemed like an opportunity to explore a part of the conversation that nobody had been having, but also, as a storyteller, I'm looking for the ingredients for good dramatic storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
People who want something, it seems like they can't have. And when not knowing much about autism at the time, I sure didn't understand how someone who was on the spectrum could have a romantic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seemed like a great place to explore.
Absolutely. And when I saw it, I said, wow, now that's interesting, because when you know someone who has autism and you know the characteristics of it, and that's why they call it the spectrum, because it runs from one end to the other. And, what about love for them? That's a really interesting topic.
Yeah, it really is. And to your point, there's this great quote, and I think it was Dr. Stephen Shore who said it, and it's that when you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism.
Exactly.
Meaning that there's a spectrum. It's so complex. Mm-hmm. Everybody is affected so differently by it. And that's life, too, isn't it, right? I mean, that's true.
Yes.
Outside of the spectrum. So I think that even if you don't have a relationship to autism, you can appreciate how complex and unique these individuals are. And I think it was important to get that message out because it's certainly not the impression that we have at large and, you know, in kind of in popular media. I think it's reduced to a particular kind of, you know, a stereotypical mm-hmm. image of autism.
Mm-hmm.
And it was important for us to challenge that, and hopefully the film does a lot to shatter it.
You know, something else, too, that I think in general terms we think when we think about autism, we think about children. So we don't mm-hmm. think about these children have to grow into an adult.
Right, exactly. And you know, we've got this generation of kids really who have been diagnosed.
Absolutely.
And I think as they've started to grow, parents in particular, and then the rest of kind of the community is starting to wonder what their adult lives are
mm-hmm.
going to look like. And, you know, many times if you talk to a parent, they will define a successful, happy life for their child if they can have a relationship, fall in love, and experience that part of the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was really important for us to start looking at that and understand what that was going to be like for this generation of kids who are getting diagnosed with autism.
Yes, yes. They got to grow up. So you go into the lives of four adults, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So talk about it a little bit.
Yep. Yeah, so we dig into the lives of these four adults. You know, what was really important to us in this film was to, as accurately as one film can, really represent the full spectrum of autism,
mm-hmm.
right? We wanted to have people in the film who are affected by autism very differently, but we also wanted to represent the spectrum of love and relationship.
Mm.
So, you know, we've got our character Lenny, who is a young man struggling to kind of come to terms with his diagnosis and looking for a relationship. He clearly wants love, but trying to reconcile who he is and how he fits into you know, a romantic relationship is really a challenge for him.
Mm-hmm.
Lindsay and Dave are a couple who have been together for quite some time and are, you know, in the beginning of the film, trying to identify what the next steps of their relationships are. You know, where are they going to be and what does that look like for them? And then we've got Stephen, who I'll be a little vague here because I want the audience
yes.
all the surprises. But, you know, Stephen is, I would say, the most obviously affected or maybe most mm-hmm. stereotypically affected by autism. He's, you know, kind of later in his life and has really been challenged by autism, but has also really done a lot to put together an independent life for himself. He works, he does have a long-term relationship, lives on his own, and really has made his way in the world despite his very obvious and affecting challenges. And so, you know, in the idea of creating a portrait of both autism and romance, it was important to us to really, really have that breadth and have very unique subjects. And I think we did that, and I hope that audiences really feel like they get to know these folks and therefore more deeply understand the autism spectrum
mm-hmm.
and maybe romance, too.
So I know some of them are highly functioning. And then did you go down to the lower end of the spectrum on this?
You know, it's a kind of a term and a question I tend to stay away from because
mm-hmm.
I know that there's, you know, the idea of higher versus lower functioning
right.
seems to be kind of a tender issue. So it's hard for me to say where people fall on the spectrum, but what I can say is that each of the subjects are affected in very obviously
mm-hmm.
different ways. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mentioned Stephen earlier, who is really challenged by speech. You know, he didn't speak until he was a teenager, and that was really only thanks to some very intense high-level
wow.
therapy. And so, you know, like I said, everybody has their own unique challenges
mm-hmm.
and they're all working very hard to overcome those and have what they would consider a normal, fulfilling, happy life.
So what did you learn about, in what really struck you in the relationships, in the quest to find love for these young people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, the relationships happen in a couple ways. One, it's the relationships you see between the subjects and their either, you know, their hopeful romantic partners or the ones they already have. And those relationships are so beautiful and complex and unique, as unique as the individuals are. You know, the other relationship that struck me was the one that I built with the subjects. I mean,
mm-hmm.
a film like this necessitates a sense of intimacy between the audience and the subjects, and it was my job as the director to create that. And so I had to become close to these folks and really become a part of their lives. And that was really affecting for me. I mean, I built some very deep friendships as a part of this. And they really taught me a lot. I mean, Lindsay and Dave, I think in particular, are really very wise, insightful, deep people who really helped me more deeply understand what it means to connect to somebody romantically, and moreover, what it means to love yourself in spite of any perceived limitations or challenges, which I think we
can all
remember, whether or not we're on the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I thought about that too, is that they just have some different challenges than all the rest of us, but we all have challenges.
We do, right. And I think, you know, again, when audiences watch this film and connect to it, I think that barrier and those labels will kind of melt away and we'll see how close we all really are. I mean, the challenges that people on the autism spectrum face and the ones that, you know, neurotypical folks face are often very similar. And I think that's pretty striking.
Did you interview their family members in any of the groups, any of the relationships?
Yeah, we did. And those appear in varying levels in the film. It was important for us that the subjects had a voice and that this film wasn't other people talking about them, but rather them having an opportunity to speak for themselves and share their point of view and their story. So we did interview the families, and they do appear in the film, but it's really in a minimal way, only for background context, so you can more deeply understand where these folks come from. But, you know, I do want to be clear, it really is the folks on the spectrum's voice and their perspective that is driving the film.
That is going to be a beautiful, beautiful story. Have they all seen it?
Thank you.
Have they all seen it?
They have not all seen it yet. Mm-hmm. Lindsay and Dave were with us at our premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival earlier this year, and they've you know, really been a part of kind of the rollout of the film. So they're very active and involved in it. But you know, there have been some choices to share the film in at the right time with some of the other subjects for reasons their families and I have kind of decided. But they are big supporters of the project. They're aware of everything that's going on and what's happening in the film, and you know, big champions of all that we hope the film does for the community.
So talk about the emotions. Are we going to laugh, cry, or is it serious? Is it funny?
Excuse me. Well, I hope you do it all. I mean, that's my definition of a good movie, right? You laugh, you cry, you feel like you go on a journey and you learn a little something. And I think we hit all four in this film. There are certainly some moments that are funny and humorous and light. And there are some moments that are really very raw and vulnerable, and those can be painful, but it's in service of growth and connection to the subjects and their journey. So I think that it's very cathartic, and I think, you know, that folks are going to get very close to these characters, understand them, and hopefully learn something about themselves in the process.
That's awesome. Awesome, awesome. It's going to be on Independent Lens, and so if you miss it, on Monday, January 11th, 10 p.m. to 11 p.m., you check your local listings because they repeat it. I think they even put them online, don't they, Matt?
That's right. They're online for, I'm not sure the period of time, but I think it's a week after the initial broadcast.
Right.
But the great news is that we're also going to be available on Netflix shortly after the PBS broadcast. So folks can catch us there. We're available in all the digital retailers, and folks can come to our website, autismandlove.com, if they're interested in DVDs or Blu-rays.
All right. Matt Fuller, director of Autism and Love. It's going to be seen on Independent Lens on tomorrow, Monday, January 11th, 10 to 11 p.m. Check your local listings on PBS. Thank you so much for joining us, Matt.
Thank you, Twanda.